Welcome to Between the Margins, a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. My name is Michelle Boyce, and the topic we're covering today is the topic of Dr. Seuss. And for those that don't know, Dr. Seuss is not only the world's number one children's author, but he's also gets rather political in his storytelling, and there's always a social justice theme. So today on this show, it's going to be more documentary format, and we're going to talk about Dr. Seuss. And to introduce the show, here's a clip.
We all grew up loving the books of Dr. Seuss, the whimsical drawings, the clever rhymes. Who knew there was a message behind the mirth? From foreign policy to race relations, Dr. Seuss was always saying a lot more than, "I don't like green eggs and ham. Guess who Riddle the Turtle was supposed to be?" The political Dr. Seuss.
On March 2nd, 1904, in the town of Springfield, Massachusetts, a boy named Theodore Seuss Geisel was born. His family had owned a brewery for two generations, enjoying great economic success. This financial stability was threatened with the onset of Prohibition and World War I. The Geisels, being German immigrants, became the target of many racial slurs. In order to overcome their heritage, the family became very involved in pro-American activities. Despite the financial and social hardships, the family prospered and Ted enjoyed a comfortable childhood. There are numerous influences from Ted's childhood that are apparent in his works. Many of his books include illustrations that reflect landmarks and objects in the town of Ted's childhood. Ted's mother, Henrietta Seuss Geisel, would often chant rhymes to her children when they had difficulty falling asleep. Ted recognized his mother as a major source of his ability to rhyme. It seems that Ted was a cartoonist at heart, even in grade school. He could often be found doodling on the edges of his papers. His teachers considered the drawings eccentric and disapproved of them. Regardless, Ted continued drawing all through his grade school and high school years. He also spent these years writing humorous poems and rhymes, as well as a column for his high school's newspaper.
Theodore Seuss Geisel, known as Dr. Seuss by most Americans, wasn't just the children's author that we think of him as. It wasn't even a vocation he considered. As a boy in Springfield, Massachusetts, he developed a love of designing complicated contraptions from his father, and a love of poetry from his mother. For a time, Ted's father worked as superintendent of the Springfield Zoo, and Ted would take his sketchbook to the zoo and draw the animals. Throughout high school and college, he wrote and drew cartoons for his school's newspapers and literary magazines. It was at Dartmouth that he started using the pen name Seuss, pronounced like his mother's maiden name.
After graduating from Dartmouth in 1925, Ted still hadn't settled on a career to pursue. He proceeded to Oxford to become a doctor, as his father wanted. He continued doodling on his papers, and one drawing caught the eye of Helen Palmer, a fellow American. Helen suggested that Ted become an artist, which he did, and the pair became good friends. After his decision, Ted dropped out of Oxford and spent the remainder of the year traveling Europe with friends. They visited Paris, where Ted asked Helen to marry him. They were married in 1927.
Back home in Springfield, he sent cartoons to dozens of magazines, until he finally sold a cartoon to Saturday Evening Post for $25. Ted Geisel decided that this signaled success and moved to New York to pursue his career. Judge Magazine, as well as Life and the Saturday Evening Post, used many of his drawings and cartoons, but he also built a lucrative advertising career. In 1927, Standard Oil Company noticed that Dr. Seuss had used one of their products, Flit, in his cartoons. They hired him, and his slogan, Quick Henry, the Flit, became a very common phrase.
Ted spent over 15 years in advertising for such companies as Ford, General Electric, Holly Sugar, and others. The idea for his first book was dreamed up while he and his wife were headed for vacation. While on the cruise ship, Ted was bothered by the rhythm of the engines. Helen suggested that he make the rhythm into a rhyme and came up with the phrase, "And to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street."
In 1937, Dr. Seuss wrote his first book, originally titled A Story That No One Could Beat. It was rejected by 27 publishing companies. One day, while walking the streets of New York, ready to give up on this book, he ran into a college buddy who had just become a children's editor for Random House. His friend suggested that he change the name of the book to And to Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street. The book immediately became a bestseller.
When I leave home to walk to school, Dad always says to me,
Marco, keep your eyelids up and see what you can see.
But when I tell him where I've been and what I think I've seen, he looks at me and sternly says,
Your eyesight's much too keen. Stop telling such outlandish tales. Stop turning minnows into whales.
Now what can I say when I go home today? All the long way to school and all the way back, I've looked and I've looked and I've kept careful track. But all that I've noticed except my own feet was a horse and a wagon on Mulberry Street. That's nothing to tell of. That won't do, of course. Just a broken-down wagon that's drawn by a horse. That can't be my story. That's only a start. It still doesn't seem right. An elephant pulling a thing that's so light would whip it around in the air like a kite. But he'd look simply grand with a great big brass band. Band is so good, should have someone to hear it, but it's going so fast that it's hard to keep near it. I'll put on a trailer. I know they won't mind if a man sits and listens, or haste on behind. But now is that fair? Is it fair what I've done? I bet those wagons weigh more than a ton. That's really too heavy a load for one beast. I'll give him some helpers. He needs two at least. The mayor is there, and he thinks it is grand to raise his hat as they dash by the stand. The mayor is there, and the older man, too, are waving big banners of red, white, and blue. And that is a story that no one can beat when I say that I saw it on Mulberry Street. No time for more, I'm almost home. I swung round the corner and dashed through the gate. I ran up the steps. I felt simply great, for I had a story that no one could beat. And to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street. But Dad said quite calmly,
Just drop your stool and tell me the sights on the way home from school.
There was so much to tell, I just couldn't begin. Dad looked at me sharply and pulled in his chin. He frowned at me sternly from there in his seat.
Was there nothing to look at, no people to greet? Did nothing excite you or make your heart beat?
Nothing, I said, growing red as a beet. But a plain horse and wagon on Mulberry Street.
Dr. Seuss, the best-selling children's author of all time, revolutionized the way kids learn to read with one simple idea. He made it fun.
He was the only guy I know who's ever invented words because he needed a gox. Have you ever boxed a gox? You know, in socks?
He takes full advantage of the idea that anything goes. He can do anything he possibly wants to.
So they slumped in their chairs, too glum to complain. And to make matters worse, it started to rain.
While Dr. Seuss is the most famous children's author of all time, Theodore Geisel remains more of an enigma.
You know, Cat in the Hat and all those books, I think those really become like the first books you ever read when you're a child. And the brilliance of those books, I think, is that Geisel's rhythm that he writes in makes you want to read.
I know for me that when I was growing up, Dr. Seuss was a major part of my growing up experience in my life. And when my children were being raised and they were little, we had the entire Dr. Seuss collection and read to them prenatal. And then once they were born, we read to them. And Dr. Seuss classics were always part of our everyday ritual here in our family, and I'm sure it's been every family ever since, that everyone out there in Radioland has always had a Dr. Seuss story as part of their world and part of their lives. And it started out with Dr. Seuss, and in that beginning book, he was talking about how grown-ups tend to stifle children's imagination. And Dr. Seuss has always been a firm believer in building children's imaginations and letting that imagination thrive and never, ever stifling that imagination and letting them build their stories and build their lives and, you know, explore worlds outside of reality and, you know, just be kids. And he was wonderful at bringing out those imaginatory stories and bringing them to life for children to see.
In 1941, Ted Geisel showed a cartoon to one of the owners of PM Magazine, a liberal political tabloid in New York City. The cartoon was about a fascist Italian newspaper editor named Virginio Gaeta. PM Magazine hired him as their chief political cartoonist, a job he held until 1943. The 400 cartoons he created for PM took potshots at such issues as inflation, taxes, racism, anti-Semitism, and the war effort. An organization he was strongly opposed to was the America First Committee. Charles Lindbergh and several influential Republican congressmen were part of this group, which opposed America's involvement in the war. They were anti-Semitic and somewhat racist. Dr. Seuss portrayed them as ostriches who put their heads in the sand rather than see what was actually happening. He strongly believed that if America listened to the America First Committee, our country could be Hitler's next victim. Some of Ted's PM cartoons promoted buying war stocks and bonds. This was the major way that the United States financed World War II. From his youth on, he had always believed that a little humor mixed in with a more serious issue was a better way to get people's attention than just stating the facts. Many of Geisel's wartime cartoons, especially those targeting the Japanese, would today be considered racist, but they reflected the mindset of the United States at this time. This open prejudice seems out of character to the Dr. Seuss we know in his children's books. Then, in 1943, Ted felt that he owed his country some service, but he was too old for the Army, so he decided to join the Army Signal Corps. He was stationed in Hollywood, California, at the 20th Century Fox studio lot, which is called Fort Fox by the Signal Corps. Ted's job was to create films and pamphlets that were used to instruct and train soldiers. One of Ted's creations was Private Snafu. Snafu was a klutz in the Army that always messed up everything he did. Ted created 28 different Snafu cartoons to show the men in the Army what not to do. The Gold Brick showed how laziness and irresponsibility can affect the war, while Rumors taught the importance of keeping some information quiet. Snafuperman shows what can happen when someone doesn't plan his strategies for action. The Army had created technical manuals to teach soldiers how to avoid illnesses and other dangers, but these books were a failure. Nobody paid much attention to them. So Ted and another children's book writer, Monroe Leaf, were commissioned to create a humorous booklet to warn soldiers about the dangers of malaria, a deadly disease that was carried by mosquitoes. Unlike most of the military booklets, Dr. Seuss added a humorous twist to This Is Anne. This was one of the many pieces of information, written and filmed, that he composed to inform soldiers in an interesting way. In 1945, Geisel created two major films that were used to inform soldiers about the post-war. One, titled Your Job in Germany, was about how the Germans could not be trusted. War, fake peace, war, fake peace. The German history book repeated itself always. This was the main message that Ted tried to get across in this film. The other film that he composed was entitled Our Job in Japan. This film was aimed towards soldiers about to enter Japan to participate in the Allied occupation after World War II. These two films were the base for two later movies. Hitler Lives, released in 1945, was based off of Your Job in Germany. Design for Death, released in 1947, was based off of Our Job in Japan. Both movies used much of their original footage in their reproductions. After the war, Dr. Seuss returned to writing his beloved children's books that he had put aside for the past 7 years.
An article was published in the 1954 issue of Life magazine entitled Why Johnny Can't Read. The article blamed children's lack of interest toward reading on the books themselves, saying they were boring.
Children's books should require illustrations that widen rather than narrow the associative richness the children give to the words.
When Ted heard this distressing fact, he resolved to reverse the problem by writing books that would interest as well as educate children. He wrote The Cat in the Hat using a vocabulary of only 220 words off of a list of vocabulary for beginning readers.
Too wet to go out and too cold to play ball. So we sat in the house. We did nothing at all. So all we could do was to sit. And we did not like it. Not one little bit. And then something went bump. How that bump made us jump. We looked. Then we saw him step in on the mat. We looked, and we saw him, the Cat in the Hat. And he said to us,
"Why do you sit there like that? I know it is wet, and the sun is not sunny, but we can have lots of good fun that is funny. I know some good games we could play,"
said the cat.
"I know some new tricks,"
said the Cat in the Hat.
"A lot of good tricks. I will show them to you. Your mother will not mind at all if I do."
Then Sally and I did not know what to say. Our mother was out of the house for the day. But our fish said,
"No, no. Make that cat go away. Tell that Cat in the Hat you do not want to play. He should not be here. He should not be about. He should not be here when your mother is out."
"Now, now, have no fear. Have no fear,"
said the cat.
"My tricks are not bad,"
said the Cat in the Hat.
"Why, we can have lots of good fun, if you wish, with a game that I call Up, Up, Up with a Fish."
During the tremendous success of the Cat in the Hat, Tedco established the Beginner's Books division of Random House Publishing. Soon after, Seuss's publisher, Bennett Cerf, bet $50 that he couldn't write an entire book using only 50 words. This wager led to the creation of Green Eggs and Ham, which followed the guidelines and used the variations of only 50 words.
"Oh, I frequently think every now and then of the glorious fruit of the noble hen. Eggs, eggs, E-double-G-S eggs. My knowledge of eggs is tremendously wide. I've eaten them boiled, I've eaten them fried, poached and shirred and deviled and scrambled, omelets, schmomelets, coddled and frambled. I've eaten them beaten and swizzled and swizzled, frizzled, gadizzled, bamboozled and fuzzled. I know every way that an egg can be guzzled. And thinking of eggs reminds me of Sam, whose favorite dish is Green Eggs and Ham."
"I am Sam. Sam I am.
That Sam I am, that Sam I am. I do not like that Sam I am.
Do you like green eggs and ham?"
"I do not like them, Sam I am. I do not like green eggs and ham."
"He does not like them, Sam I am. He doesn't like green eggs and ham."
"Would you like them here or there?"
"I would not like them here or there. I would not like them anywhere. I do not like green eggs and ham. I do not like them, Sam I am."
"He doesn't like green eggs and ham. He doesn't like them."
"Would you like them in a house? Would you like them with a mouse?"
"I would not like them in a house. I would not like them with a mouse. I would not like them here or there. I would not like them anywhere."
"Green eggs and ham. He doesn't like green eggs and ham. He doesn't like them. He doesn't like green eggs and ham."
Ted's unparalleled imagination led to many people asking the same question: where did the ideas come from? Ted's answer served only to emphasize his distinctive wit.
"I got all my ideas in Switzerland, near the Forca Pass. There is a little town called Glutch, and 2,000 feet up above Glutch, there is a smaller hamlet called Uberglutch. I go there on the 4th of August every summer to get my cuckoo clock repaired. While the cuckoo is in the hospital, I wander around and talk to the people in the streets. They are very strange people, and I get my ideas from them."
Ahoo-dores, welcome Christmas, bring your light. Ahoo-dores, ahoo-dores, welcome in the cold of night.
Every Who down in Whoville liked Christmas a lot, but the Grinch, who lived just north of Whoville, did not. The Grinch hated Christmas, the whole Christmas season. Now, please don't ask why. No one quite knows the reason. It could be, perhaps, that his shoes were too tight. It could be his head wasn't screwed on just right. But I think that the most likely reason of all may Abinderi's heart was two sizes too small.
After being married for 40 years, Helen's failing health began to get the best of her. She died on October 27, 1967. Ted married his longtime friend, Audrey Diamond, on June 21, 1968. She brought him stability and support, and continues to this day as the head of Dr. Seuss Enterprises.
All in all, the immortal words and works of Dr. Seuss made an enormous, lasting impression on people everywhere.
If you think of Seuss's legacy, it's to be creative, to think outside the box. That's part of his lasting appeal.
Fox in Socks by Dr. Seuss.
Fox socks, box knocks, knocks in box, fox in socks, knocks on fox in socks in box, socks on knocks and knocks in box, fox in socks on box on knocks. Chicks with bricks come, chicks with flocks come, chicks with bricks and blocks and flocks come.
Look sir, Mr. Knox sir, let's do tricks with bricks and blocks sir. Let's do tricks with chicks and flocks sir. First I'll make a quick trick brick stack, then I'll make a quick trick block stack. You can make a quick trick chick stack, you can make a quick trick clock stack. And here's a new trick, Mr. Knox, socks on chicks and chicks on fox, fox on clocks on bricks and blocks, bricks and blocks on knots on box. Now we come to kicks and tocks, sir. Try to say this, Mr. Knox, sir. Clocks on fox tick, clocks on knocks tock. Sick, sick, bricks tick, sick, sick, chicks tock.
Please, sir, I don't like this trick, sir. My tongue isn't quick or slick, sir. I get all those ticks and clocks, sir, mixed up with the chicks and tocks, sir. I can't do it, Mr. Fox, sir.
I'm so sorry, Mr. Knox, sir. Here's an easy game to play. Here's an easy thing to say. New socks, two socks. Whose socks? Sue's socks. Who sews whose socks? Who sews Sue's socks? Who sees whose? So who's new socks, sir? You see Suso Sue's new socks, sir.
That's not easy, Mr. Fox, sir.
Who comes? Crow comes. Slow Joe Crow comes. Who sews crow's clothes? Suso's crow's clothes. Slow Joe Crow sews who's clothes? Sue's clothes. Suso socks a fox in socks now. Slow Joe Crow sews Knox in box now. Suso's rose on Slow Joe Crow's clothes. Fox sews hose on Slow Joe Crow's nose. Hose goes. Rose grows. Nose hose goes some. Crow's rose grows some.
Mr. Fox, I hate this game, sir. This game makes my tongue quite lame, sir.
Mr. Knox, sir, what a shame, sir. We'll find something new to do now. Now, here is lots of new blue goo now. New goo, blue goo, gooey, gooey, blue goo. New goo, gluey, gluey, gooey goo for chewy chewing. That's what that goo goose is doing. Do you choose to chew goo too, sir? If, sir, you, sir, choose to chew, sir, with the goo goose, chew, sir, do, sir.
Mr. Fox, sir, I won't do it. I can't say it. I won't chew it.
Very well, sir. Step this way. We'll find another game to play. Bim comes. Ben comes. Bim brings Ben broom. Ben brings Bim broom. Ben bends Bim's broom. Bim bends Ben's broom. Bim's bends. Ben's bends. Ben's bent broom breaks. Bim's bent broom breaks. Ben's bend. Bim's bend. Big bends. Pig bends. Bim and Ben lead bends with brooms. Ben's bend bangs and Bim's bend booms.
Pig bend, boom bend, big bend, broom bend. My poor mouth can't say that. No, sir. My poor mouth is much too slow, sir.
Fox and Socks is that tongue twister that I could never wrap my tongue around when I was trying to read it to my children. But it was always fun. And Dr. Seuss's different rhyming is always something to be talked about, because there's a couple of different ways that he uses rhyming in his publications to do the work that he's doing. The one poetic meter that he uses is anapestic tetrameter, one example of that is in Yertle the Turtle and Other Stories, and today the great Yertle, the marvelous he, is king of the mud and all he can see. And that's, so that's that type of poetic meter that he uses in those, which is one of the reasons that his writing is so well received. And the other way that he uses poetry in this is what's called the trochaic tetrameter. And one of the examples of that is one fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish, where it has a strong beat followed by a weak beat, and four units per line. So he employed those two basic different meters in his work. It was very well received by children and adults around the world. One of the things that people don't know about Dr. Seuss is that it's actually not pronounced Seuss. And one of his collaborators in Dartmouth wrote a little poem. You're wrong as the deuce, and you shouldn't rejoice. If you're calling him Seuss, he pronounces it Zeus. So, but he anglicized the pronunciation because he felt that it evoked an advantageous for an author of children's books to be associated with Mother Goose. And most people use this pronunciation. And the other pen name, interesting enough, is that when he wrote books that others illustrated, he used the pen name Theo Lissig, which is Giselle, his first name spelled backwards. So just a few different tidbits of trivia about someone who is extremely important in my world and is in my list of top five individuals that are my heroes and my idols that I use to, you know, to guide my life and to, you know, help me along in my world and, you know, people I look up to. So we'll be back after the break with more of the social justice parts of Dr. Seuss and the political, because Dr. Seuss was extremely political in nature. We'll be back after these breaks on Between the Margins, a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after on CHRW 94.9 FM.
We are all in this together.
Welcome back to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. This is a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after, which aligns nicely with the gentleman that we are talking about, and that is Ted Giesel, or better known to the world as Dr. Seuss. Dr. Seuss presents a distinctly negative aspect of government and authority in such tales like Yertle the Turtle and 500 Hats of Bartholomew Cubans. Seuss shows political authority as potentially selfish and exploitive, thirsting for more power, heedless of the best interests of the community. Their stories appear to argue that government should be limited in its scope, which is a message that the Occupy movement brings today to us in the 99%. But the real politics of Dr. Seuss comes in his concerns about family dynamics. In the 1950s, the patriarchal "because I said so" approach to child rearing was replaced with a different style of interaction in which parents set boundaries for their kids but let them explore and experiment, and Dr. Seuss brought them to life. Seuss felt that the best children's stories acknowledged and worked through children's anger towards parental rules, and that in doing so, they respected children's innate sense of justice. Seuss seems to be getting at the absurdity of adult demands which run counter to the children's natures, parental expectations which transform innocent behavior into misconduct. Over the next couple of minutes, we're going to go over the politics of Dr. Seuss and how some of his pieces have a direct relation to the political climate of the time. Horton Hears a Who, Yertle the Turtle, The Sneetches, and the Butter Battle book. And this here goes over those things and gives you some examples of the politics of Dr. Seuss.
Think of nobody here, and the feeling of fear, and the darkness of night. All alone in your room, as you're facing your doom,
think a glimmer of light.
Largest of all.
You can't get me, and they can't.
some of his other books, he used his writing as a vehicle to get out his messages about racism, protecting the earth, and lessons from history. In 1951, Dr. Seuss visited Japan and observed the changes resulting from the American occupation of Japan following World War II. The Japanese people had a new government, a new educational system, and were preparing to vote for the first time. Seuss was struck by the idea that the Japanese people were finally having the opportunity to have a voice in their country, and how important that was. From those thoughts, Horton Hears a Who was created, with the folks from Whoville representing the people of Japan, because a person is a person, no matter how small.
On the 15th of May, in the jungle of Newell, in the heat of the day, in the cool of the pool, he was splashing, enjoying the jungle's great joys, when Horton the elephant heard a small noise.
Help!
Then he heard it again, just a very faint yelp.
Help!
As if some tiny person were calling for help. He looked and he looked. He could see nothing there but a small speck of dust drifting down through the air.
Help!
Most highly peculiar. He'd never heard tell of a small speck of dust that was able to yell.
Help! Please help!
You know what I think? I suspect that there must be something alive on that small speck of dust. Some sort of a person of a very small size, too small to be seen by my elephant's eyes. If so, I should save him, because after all, a person's a person, no matter how small. There, whoever you are, all your troubles are over. I'll put you down safe on this comfortable clover.
Look!
It was Jane Kangaroo, and the small kangaroo in her pouch said,
"Help too."
Why, that stick is as small as the head of a pin. A person on that? There never has been.
I know it seems strange, but I tell you, sincerely, these extra big ears of mine heard him quite clearly.
Horton, I've known you 12 years in the jungle of Newell, and I've always considered you somewhat a fool. But talking to dust specks, that is really cuckoo. Something has got to be done about you, and something's precisely what I'm going to do.
And the small kangaroo in her pouch said,
"Me too."
Come on, Junior.
You're certainly lucky that I'm still around. This is twice in one day that you've almost been drowned.
I know, and we're eternally grateful to know that you care.
There is. There really is someone down there.
And I wish to say this. You're a most splendid friend. You've helped everyone here on this dust speck no end. You've saved all our houses, our ceilings and floors. You've saved all our churches and grocery stores.
What? You have buildings there too?
Oh, our buildings to you might seem terribly small, but to persons of our size, they're really quite tall.
But this is incredible. What are you anyhow?
Not what, sir. I'm a who.
A who? You're a who?
Yes, a who. W-H-O. Who? I live here in Whoville.
And what does a who do?
Who do? Well, I am Dr. H. Hoovy, professor of science. I've worked 50 years on my Whoscope appliance to prove to the people who live in this place that there are worlds beyond ours, like yours, out in space. But the people down here don't believe me. They don't.
That's perfectly right, Doc. We don't and we won't.
Fooey to hold the old Hoovy's a jerk.
That's their opinion of me and my work.
Yurtle the Turtle was written in 1958. Dr. Seuss had stated that the character, King Yurtle, represented Adolf Hitler. With Yurtle's dictator rule of the pond and takeover of the surrounding area, being just like Hitler's rule of Germany and his invasion of various parts of Europe. Originally, Yurtle even had a mustache, but Dr. Seuss decided that it was a little too obvious.
Please! I don't like to complain, but down here below we are feeling great pain. I know up there on top you are seeing great sights, but down here at the bottom, we too should have rights. We turtles can't stand it. Our shells will soon crack. Besides, we need food. We are starving.
Groaned Mac.
No breakfast, no lunch. If we stand here much longer, I fear, O King Yurtle, we'll all die of hunger.
You hush up your mouth,
howled the mighty King Yurtle.
You've no right to talk to the world's highest turtle. I rule from the clouds, over land, over sea. There's nothing, no nothing, that's higher than me.
But then, Yurtle looked up. Yurtle saw with surprise that the moon of the evening was starting to rise up over his head in the darkening skies. Up there, the bright moon was beginning to glow high over the king of the turtles below.
Now what's that?
Snorted Yurtle.
Say, what is that thing that dares to go higher than Yurtle the king? I shall not allow it. I'll go higher still. I'll build my throne higher. I can and I will. I'll call some more turtles. I'll stack 'em to heaven. I need about 5,607.
But as Yurtle the Turtle King lifted his hand and started to order and give the command, that plain little turtle below in the stack, that plain little turtle whose name was just Mac, decided he'd taken enough. And he had. And that plain little lad got a little bit mad. And that plain little Mac did a plain little thing. He burped. And his burp shook the throne of the king. And Yurtle the Turtle, the king of the trees, the king of the air and the birds and the bees, the king of a house and a cow and a mule. Well, that was the end of the Turtle King's rule. For Yurtle, the king of all Salamisand, fell off his high throne and fell plunk in the pond. And today, the great Yurtle, that marvelous he, is king of the mud. That is all he can see. And the turtles, of course, all the turtles are free. As turtles and, maybe, all creatures should be.
The Sneetches, created in 1961, took on racism and anti-Semitism, and drove home the point that appearance should not matter.
Now the star-belly Sneetches had bellies with stars. The plain-belly Sneetches had none upon theirs. Those stars weren't so big, they were really so small. You might think such a thing wouldn't matter at all. But because they had stars, all the star-belly Sneetches would brag. We're the best kind of Sneetch on the beaches. With their snoots in the air, they would sniff and they'd snort. We'll have nothing to do with the plain-belly sort. And whenever they met some when they were out walking, they'd hike right on past them without even talking. When the star-belly children went out to play ball, could a plain-belly get in the game? Not at all. You only could play if your bellies had stars, and the plain-belly children had none upon theirs. One day, it seems, while the plain-belly Sneetches were moping and doping alone on the beaches, just sitting there wishing their bellies had stars, a stranger zipped up in the strangest of cars. My friends, he announced in a voice clear and keen, my name is Sylvester McMonkey McBean, and I've heard of your troubles. I've heard you're unhappy. But I can fix that. I'm the fix-it-up chappy. I've come here to help you. I have what you need, and my prices are low, and I work at great speed. And my work is 100% guaranteed. Then quickly Sylvester McMonkey McBean put together a very peculiar machine. And he said, "You want stars like a Starbelly Sneetch? My friends, you can have them for just $3 each." When the Plain Belly Sneetches popped out, they had stars. They actually did. They had stars upon stars. Then they yelled at the ones that had stars at the start. "We're exactly like you. You can't tell us apart. We're all just the same now, you snooty old smarties. And now we can go to your Frankfurter parties." "Good grief," groaned the ones who had stars at the first. "We're still the best sneetches, and they are the worst. But now, how in the world will we know?" they all frowned. "Belly stars are no longer in style," said McBean. "What you need is a trip through my star-off machine. This wondrous contraption will take off your stars, so you won't look like sneetches who have them on theirs. And that handy machine, working very precisely, removed all the stars from their tummies quite nicely." Then with snoots in the air, they paraded about, and they opened their beaks and they let out a shout. "We know who is who now. There isn't a doubt.
Yeah.
The best kind of sneetches are sneetches without." Then, of course, those with stars all got frightfully mad. To be wearing a star now was frightfully bad. Then, of course, old Sylvester McMonkey McBean invited them into his star-off machine. Then, of course, from then on, as you probably guess, things really got into a horrible mess. All the rest of that day on those wild, screaming beaches, the fix-it-up chappie kept fixing up sneetches. Off again, on again, in again, out again. Through the machine they raced round and about again, changing their stars every minute or two. They kept paying money, they kept running through, until neither the plane nor the star bellies knew whether this one was that one, or that one was this one, or which one was what one, or what one was who. Then when every last cent of their money was spent, the fix-it-up chappie packed up and he went. And he laughed as he drove in his car up the beach. "They never will learn, no. You can't teach a sneetch." But McBean was quite wrong, I'm quite happy to say, that the sneetches got really quite smart on that day, the day they decided that sneetches are sneetches, and no kind of sneetch is the best on the beaches.
In 1971, Dr. Seuss created one of his favorite books, The Lorax, which showed how important it is to take care of the environment.
And at that very moment, we heard a loud whack. From outside in the fields came a sickening smack of an axe on a tree. Then we heard the tree fall. The very last truffular tree of them all. No more trees. No more needs. No more work to be done. So in no time, my uncles and aunts, every one, all waved me goodbye. They jumped into my cars and drove away under the smoke-smothered stars. Now all that was left neath the bad-smelling sky was my big empty factory, the Lorax, and I. The Lorax said nothing, just gave me a glance, just gave me a very sad, sad backward glance, as he lifted himself by the seat of his pants. And I'll never forget the grim look on his face when he hoisted himself and took leave of this place through a hole in the smog without leaving a trace. And all that the Lorax left here in this mess was a small pile of rocks with the one word, unless. Whatever that meant, well, I just couldn't guess. That was long, long ago, but each day since that day, I've sat here and worried. And worried away through the years while my buildings have fallen apart. I've worried about it with all of my heart. But now, says the onceler, now that you're here, the word of the Lorax seems perfectly clear. Unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing is going to get better. It's not. So catch, calls the onceler. He lets something fall. It's a truffula seed. It's the last one of all. You're in charge of the last of the truffula seeds. And truffula trees are what everyone needs. Plant a new truffula. Treat it with care. Give it clean water and feed it fresh air. Grow a forest. Protect it from axes that hack. Then the Lorax and all of his friends may come back.
The Pulitzer Prize-winning Butter Battle book was published in 1984. This book, which parodied the Cold War, told the tale of two cities fighting each other about which way they should butter their bread. It showed how trivial the Cold War was.
On the last day of summer, 10 hours before fall, my grandfather took me out of the wall. For a while we stood silent, and finally said, with a very sad shake of his very old head,
"As you know, on this side of the wall, we are Ukes. On the far other side of this wall, live the Zooks. And the things that you've heard about Zooks are all true. That terribly horrible thing that they do. And in every Zook house, and in every Zook town, every Zook eats his bread with the butter side down." We Ukes, when we eat, when we breakfast or sup, we spread our bread right with the butter side up. 'Cause of course you remember our bread spreading rule that you learned as a lad back in bread spreading school. You should be down that hole and you're up here instead. But perhaps this is all for the better somehow. You will see me make history right here and right now. You will see your old gramp put an end to them all. Put an end to all those Zooks who live over the wall. Put an end to the every last village and town of those fiends who eat bread with the butter side down.
And I, my dear chap, have a message for you. Namely, I also have a big boy boomeroo. And it's my firm intention, since I have the means, to blast every Uke into small smithereens.
Grandpa, be careful. Hey, easy. Oh, gee. Who's gonna drop it? Will you or will he?
Why? Be patient. We'll see. We'll see.
Cat in the Hat, one of Dr. Seuss's most famous books, has sold more than 10.5 million copies in its classic edition alone. He wrote over 40 great books during his life. Also, Ted's books have been published in 20 different languages, with over 250 million copies sold worldwide. Most of us only know Dr. Seuss through the books he has written, but the influence goes so much further than that. His advertising affected the products that American people bought. He shaped the attitudes of the soldiers through his Signal Corps movies that he made. He inspired patriotism through advertising war bonds. But most importantly, he addressed every issue, regardless how serious, with a hint of humor.
Horton Hears a Who is not only that whimsical story about a faithful elephant that saves a civilization, but it's also a rhymed lesson in the protection of minority rights and their human rights. Yertle the Turtle is an example of how political authority can become selfish and exploitive, not unlike, the Harper government here in Canada now. And The Sneetches is one of my favorite stories of all time, because the Sneetch story is about equality and acceptance of everyone being equal and everybody having a part to play in society. I mean, it's not unlike Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, except Rudolph has to prove himself capable before the other reindeer will let him play reindeer games, whereas the Sneetch story is a more apt example of human rights, human equality, and acceptance of the diverse culture that we find ourselves faced in the world. And with the Lorax, the release of the Lorax movie, Dr. Seuss movie coming out, it's a story way back at the beginning about protecting the environment and how corporate greed and the 1% takes a hold of our natural resources and exploits them to the full detriment of our economy, our environment, and the health of the people. Not unlike what Harper government is currently doing with the oil sands in Alberta. You know, he's demolishing the environment for corporate greed. And the Cold War back in the days, and how the stupidity of that war was, and how everybody had their fingers on the buttons, and not unlike the story of the Zacks, you know, and the stubbornness of those two Zacks who would not move until everybody had to develop all of those overpasses and build around them, because those two were so determined that they were going to absolutely, without a doubt, not change their stories. So Dr. Seuss is one of my heroes. He has always been, and he will always be. Unfortunately, he passed, and that is unfortunate. But his stories live on. He avoided the media. He didn't want a big show. He wanted his words to speak for him. And I think that gift to our world is something that we will never, ever live without. And I am thankful my grandchildren will have Dr. Seuss in their lives. This has been Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. My name is Michelle Boyce. We have DJ in the booth helping. And thank you so much to everyone who produced the clips and the stories that were used on the show today. Thank you very much to everybody. If you want to hear our podcasts and our other shows, then we will have those up on BetweenTheMargins.ca. That's www.BetweenTheMargins.ca. And I hope you have your happily ever after, whatever that may look like to you.